Hi everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. So today I'm very happy to have Scott Turbin on the line, otherwise known as Cryptia on Twitter. And Scott has been doing a lot of research for years on online jihad. So today we're going to look at online jihad from 2001 up until the present, so 2015. And we're going to call this a history of jihadism. So welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Yeah, and you've been on before, so you're a returned guest. And just for our listeners, Scott is a security researcher, and as I said, he's done a lot of research on the online jihad and all kinds of things that are involved in the online jihad. So, Scott, to start off with, why don't you just explain what jihadism is and give us a brief history of it?
Okay. Well, the term comes from another online researcher who just kind of looked around and felt the same thing as I feel of there's a lot of people online who are talking a good game, but they're not really getting involved. They're not really doing anything. A lot of this stems from the post Al-Qaeda years where Al-Qaeda really tried to get people involved, but they were very esoteric. Then Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula came along and they started Inspire Magazine. And they had more of a online centric kind of approach. And so you had a combination of these magazines and you had jihadi boards, the websites out there, where these people could get together and talk. But the action seemed to be less than what they were putting out online. It was easier for them to put down the keyboard and go play a video game, you know? So, and that was the big paradigm that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula wanted people in the West specifically to, you know, go and commit jihad, some sort of act here, or come maybe and fight. But more than that, often than not, they were saying, you know, why don't you go get your Ford F-150 and put knives on the outside of it and go drive into a crowd? You know, that was actually one of their ideas in one of the magazines early on. So that's where jihadism comes from, is that kind of moniker. And it kind of set the ground for, okay, so you're trying to do this, but you're not really getting anybody really to do anything. And that's changing somewhat now with ISIS or ISIL, or as I call them usually, Daesh, because, you know, that's what I'd rather call them. And you've got things like the Garland event last week, where, you know, you've got two guys who actually were at least ideally motivated by online content from Daesh to go do this act of shooting up this Muhammad cartoon festival that was going on. So that's really where it comes from.
And so looking at this, you've got a huge time span from 2001 to the current 2015, the present. I mean, what kind of trends have we seen or changes in that long period of time?
Well, originally 2001, when I started looking at online content, it was very limited. There were obviously some web pages out there. There were little caches of documents. There was a lot of people on places like Yahoo groups talking about certain things. And that's really the genesis that I saw when I started looking around and poking at it. I was also at the beginning poking around certain networks in like Peshawar, you know, looking for open systems, things that I could look at, especially the internet cafes, because that seemed to be the place that they could go and get online, at least the easiest way. A lot of them, at the time, there wasn't a lot of infrastructure to get online. personal use wise, having it in your home at the time. So it really started off that way. Then as it progressed along, the real kind of burgeoning of the whole thing was, to me, was Yunus Suli, who called himself Erhabi 007 in 2002 or three. He started acting up, and what he was doing was he was hacking into sites and putting content up, kind of almost like defacing, but more often than not, he was actually hiding data for other people to get. So he was putting out books on how to hack. He was putting up all the media content he could get from Al Qaeda. And so he was running around making a name for himself. I was following along with what he was doing, trying to, you know, catch on to exactly who he was, as were other people. So he was the one that really kind of got people jazzed on the idea of using the net in specific ways, especially around the hacking and dumping of information. After that, the boards started to become more prevalent. You know, after we obviously went into Iraq, and the war on terror really kind of spun up, the jihadist boards became more prevalent. They started popping up in different places. There'd be, you know, servers in Malaysia that were hosting content. There were, you know, obviously servers even in the United States. There was a server hosting a website that was founded in Connecticut back in the day. It was, you know, popped finally and brought down. And actually, not too long ago, I even heard more about the case because it was still going through the courts in some way, shape, or form. But they you know, they got the guys and they, you know, took them away, put them in prison. But generally, through the years, over, you know, 2001 to I'd say 2011, there was a lot of online content in the form of these jihadist boards like Shamuk or Al-Ansar. And then you started getting, after, you know, that, the media portions of AQAP and Inspire. And then it really kind of hit the fan when Web 2.0 came along. You got Twitter. Obviously, Facebook was before that. But they started using all these media outlets, YouTube. And once the AQAP machine, the media wing, got going, that's when they started pouring this stuff online and had their own channels, you know, YouTube channels, Facebook channels. And then Twitter was the biggest change overall for the campaign, where they could get the word out. And it was hard to, you know, stamp these things out, because you could just go get another Twitter account, right? You know, you shut one down, another one pops up. Some of these guys nowadays, they have Twitter accounts. They've already preloaded other Twitter accounts. So when they get shut down, they just move to the next one.
I like the guys that have, like, how many shutdowns they've had as their sort of their badge of honor on Twitter as well.
Right. Yeah, they have their username and then a number next to it, and that's how many they've had.
Yeah.
You know, things like that. And it's a badge of honor, like you said. So I think over the years, it went from being, there were some hardcore guys, there was some communication going on that I inserted myself into and started, you know, getting into those areas and understanding how they're operating and helping where my technical abilities would, you know, help the government find where they were, you know, or what they were doing and how they were doing it, and give that to them, to now where it's just a free for all. I mean, between crypto and crypto use and Twitter and everything else, I can understand why the government seems to want to have these front door, back door crypto discussions, which I'm totally against. But if you look at it, even in the recent Senate hearing, they made the comment, you know, well, as soon as they use Wickr or any of the other encrypted sessions, they go dark. Well, yeah, but then you really, you know, should up your game and have human intelligence assets working them, You know, if they're online and they're talking openly, get somebody next to them.
So what would you consider to be the typical jihad obvious? Give us like a case example of someone.
The typical jihadist to me is someone like, there was a guy in Boston that I don't remember his name offhand, but he was talking on the boards on Shamuk and different places, and the FBI got wind of him, and they kind of sidled up to him, and they played it off that, one of their agents was somebody connected with Al Qaeda, and they set up this plan. This guy had crazy ideas about using RC planes and blowing up a building. So they gave him the materials, they gave him simulants and everything. They gave him the chances, they say, to kind of say, well, I'm not going to do this after all, you know. But he went ahead with it. And that's one kind of guy, you know, where he's going to activate. He had, though, somebody there online saying, do it here. Here, I'll enable you. I'll give you this, you know, simulant. He didn't know at the time, but I'll give you the bomb making materials. I'll give you the money. That's one thing. The most common that I see is some, and I'll just go with the Westerners, because the East, you know, the people who are in the region, it's different. It really is. It's a different way of life than being in the United States. Or even in the UK, that's Western too. But there are different ideals, different things that they're inside the milieu of, as opposed to being in the region. So a Westerner, they're playing games, they're doing whatever, unless they're super devout Muslims. And this is the thing, they just believe that they're going to, you know, be a Shahid. They're going to do that. But on average, these people are online. They're talking the talk, and unless they are, you know, surrounded by a group of people, usually physical proximity, that they can talk about this stuff and kind of egg each other on, they won't activate. They won't do anything but talk online. And we're seeing a little bit of a change now with ISIS or Daesh, because they've kind of unlocked the secret recipe on how to reach people and how to incite them. The whole idea of think about it, turn away, that we have this, you know, anti-radicalism program that's on Twitter and YouTube and everything. It really, so far, comes up very flat. We don't really do a good job at it so far, trying to turn these people away from radical jihad. On the other end of that, Daesh is really good at, you know, poking people and getting those people who are willing to act up. And so that's the big, you know, problem is, well, who's going to do that? Are they mentally unbalanced to begin with? Are they devout? Are they doing this because they really are involved, you know, at a very deep level, and they believe that this is the right thing to do? It's hard to say. You know, the two guys that went after the thing in Garland, you know, one of them at least seemed pretty devout, but we can't really interrogate them because they're dead. But, you know, at least we can see some traits in some individuals, but it's really a crapshoot. So, you know, for all the years that I've been looking, all I can say is, well, this person is saying this online, and it's up to, you know, the investigators to talk to them or find out more about them. You know, do they have a record? Have they done other things? And that's one of the things about the whole Garland thing. People were saying, well, they were on the watch list. They've been, you know, they were known by the FBI for X amount of years. And, well, you can't be watching people 24/7 all the time, physically. And evidently the FBI did actually send a warning to the Garland police because they thought maybe they were headed there. But it's hard to tell when somebody's going to activate. And these guys did not say on Twitter, yeah, we're going to go do this thing. They were smarter than the average bear, and they actually shut up.
I mean, personally, I think by looking at what's happening on social media with these individuals, it's quite hard to tell, as you said, who is just spouting out off steam and making threats just for the fun of it versus those that actually have a real intent based on the threats. Because, I mean, you can look over all kinds of radical, whether you want to have it ISIS ideology or Al-Qaeda, and there'll be threats galore on a Twitter feed about this and that, but it's quite hard to define which ones are going to actually be a legit threat versus just something that's there to terrorize people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really hard to tell who's going to activate. So we have this kind of general problem of we've got a fire hose of information, and it's hard to, you know, parse that out into who's serious and who's just being mouthy, let's say.
So looking at the technological aspect, how dependent are these jihadists on technology? Looking at, you know, we have had the rise of mobile networks, so it's not just computers. We've got mobile networks versus computers. And, like, how much does that influence this movement, the mobile networks versus computers?
Well, I think mostly what can be said about that is that it just enables it, period. I mean, mobile networks, mobile phones, smartphones are the standard today, right? So you can use any number of programs to do an encrypted chat. You can use any number of programs to get online and look at sites. I mean, the phablet market now, it's basically just a phone and a tablet, and you can do everything you can do with a PC, almost, depending on what you got and what you're able to do technically yourself. You know, if you're able to, on an Android device, root it and then even code for it, that's a whole other level. But you can just go get applications pretty easily and be able to have a conversation, either encrypted or other, or get on those same boards and post or read. And being a mobile network, you could go through Wi-Fi just like any mobile laptop as well. The local Starbucks, or, you know, just wandering around finding open APs. So the mobility factor has made it harder for tracking purposes, and it's made it easier for those who want to use it. And that's the big paradigm change. If you have pervasive wireless access everywhere, well, that's going to be hard to track somebody down, isn't it?
So
it used to be.
Yep.
Well, it used to be at the earlier days, cell phones were being used even up to into the Iraqi war. They were not so much having the wireless portion available to them all the time, or even a cell signal, but they would load videos onto these phones and then pass them around. They would share that phone or share the SIM card. You know, so that was another like sneakernet version where you could share data, you could share media. And so that's, you know, a whole other aspect of it. Now, you know, with these phablets, it's even more.
And where does that leave us looking at the technology industry? So people that are developing even more mobile technologies, faster technologies, whatever category you want to put them in, versus that idea of potentially or not potentially having a responsibility to also create their products that maybe somehow help mitigate this issue? I mean, is that even possible in this day and age?
I think it's hard to try to mitigate anything. You know, we're in a position now that post Snowden, we know that everything's being tapped as much as they can tap it. And the corporate response and the response due to public interest or demand is that encryption be a technology that's just built in the iPhone, being the one that comes to mind the most, where they said everything's going to be encrypted. You can have the option is not to go in and turn it on. You have to go in and turn it off. Mm-hmm. So that was a big switch. Now, it's a good and bad thing. I mean, it's good for all us. It's good for the bad guy who wants to encrypt their session as well. But the way I look at it is, you know, I could slip and fall and die in my tub. I'm not going to outlaw tubs. So it's a matter of just living. I mean, this is, what can you do? I don't want an authoritarian Orwellian society. And that's the penchant. You know, it seems to be like we're just going to do everything we can to get all the information we can. It hasn't really stopped all that many, as we've found, all that many terror attacks. So with or without it, it's all going to happen anyway. We just need to step up our game on law enforcement and intelligence and not just rely on the technology. I mean, let me, the 9/11 attackers were what, a mile, 2 miles away from Fort Meade before they took off. They were actually there. They were using satellite phones. They were doing things. And still they carried it off, even though the NSA was pervasively capturing as much data as they could. So, you know, it's just a fact of life. What are you going to do? Let's not go over the edge and go crazy with it, you know. But the technology is the technology. The changes will occur. And we're just going to have to deal with it the best we can, and not illegally.
How do Jihadi movements challenge or even not challenge how radicalization works today and in the past?
Well, I think for the most part, they didn't challenge anybody. They just spouted their stuff and then went and played a game. The challenge really came from Daesh, where they're actually getting some of these people to get out of their Barca lounger and go do something. And that's really a social, social media, social kind of movement that finally clicked with people. And I'm not saying there's a huge amount of people either. I mean, the statistics that were being thrown around in the Senate hearing this week, there were, I'd say, under 100, if I remember correctly, people trying to leave this country to go to Syria, you know. And those are the people, like, trying to go and try to get to the lands to fight, get some training, what have you. I'm not too worried that there's going to be a lot of people just going and activating, buying a gun or a bunch of guns and going to go shoot some mall or something. That happens outside of the radical terrorist realm, whether it be Islamic or any other terrorist. You know, I live in Connecticut. We had that kid who just shot up the school a couple of years ago, and he was just mentally ill. But that was a huge effect. So I don't see the movement or what I would call jihadists being a threat. What I do see is the social media acumen of a group like Daesh being the threat to get these certain individuals who are of a mind, who may be unbalanced or maybe just young and idealistic, to go do something. And those will be onesie-twosies. I honestly don't think, even though Daesh has a lot of money, they don't have, I think, the global reach to fund another 9/11 style attack. They have the money to do it. I don't think they have the right stuff.
Do you think technology has taken the event of radicalization outside of, say, the actual in-person community element, whether that's in a prison or a place of worship or with, you know, an individual that preaches? Has it changed that radicalization and brought it more to today's day and age of technology being a catalyst for radicalization and developing these radical ideologies? Or do you think this is just a phenomenon we're seeing, but the basic forms of radicalization are still going to stay strong and true?
I think the basic forms will always be there. I just think that the technology has enabled those who want to reach a wider audience the ability to do so very, very easily. And while it used to be with Al-Qaeda that you would have to go and train, you'd have to get your training and then they'd send you back. Like Faisal Shahzad, he went to Pakistan. He trained with the Taliban. He'd been living in the United States here. And that was a different paradigm. Today with Daesh and the way social media works is that if you're on Twitter and you're having conversations every day with somebody, you kind of know them. At least you think you do, right? You may have never met them in person, but there's a rapport. And that's what they're doing, is they're having these conversations over direct messaging or open tweets. And they're building that rapport to the point where they can, you know, incite them to do something. These people may be actively seeking them in the first place, obviously, if they're going to Twitter and they're looking these people up. Or maybe some of these guys are in some other forum and they're getting them on Twitter or some other social media to kind of spin them up. But the advent of that social technology, of being able to have that capability of having a conversation, even though it is in, you know, a technical realm, you know, it's not over the phone necessarily, but it's still personal. That's the difference. And that's how the paradigm has changed. So, yeah, it's all about the technology, really, and its pervasiveness. It's easy.
So as you just referred to, there's this notion of building trust, whether it's actually in person or, as you said, I've talked with this person via Twitter or some other social media platform, and I've developed this relationship where I trust this person. I know them, putting it in, you know, quotations, like not really knowing them, as you said, but you feel like you know them. So looking at this, I'm sure there are strengths and weaknesses of this approach. And I was wondering if we could look at what the strengths are as well as the weaknesses of doing this jihad lobbyist aspect in this way.
I think the strengths are, it's very easy to reach large numbers of individuals. And when you get large numbers of individuals, the actual numbers of potentials for an individual to actually act out is larger. So I think we've seen that with the people trying to, just using the United States as the case, go and support jihad. These girls and women who have also been involved as well, trying to go and, you know, get a husband or go and support as a Muslima in the lands. These are exhortations that they're making as well to these young women. There was a thing called the Love Jihad for a while, where AQAP in particular was trying to incite women to come and, you know, be a good Muslima and support their men, or find a man and support them so they could go commit jihad. Not so much that the women were being called to go and actually fight. So I think that it's just that asymmetric kind of warfare idea of one guy who's popular on Twitter can reach a lot of people.
I'm looking at this. What are the weaknesses, if any?
And Jim Chowdhury, you could use him as an example. Weaknesses. I think it's on the other side of that knife is that you can talk to these people and you can talk to these people and you can exhort these people, but unless they're really willing and or in a mental place where they're going to act out, you keep having to wheedle on them. So, you know, how much time are you going to invest in individuals, right? Do they have that much time? I mean, they have a media wing, they have guys who are on Twitter all the time, but you know, do they really have that much time to be getting these guys to activate? So far, we haven't seen it. So I think it's, on the one hand, it could happen. I think the likelihood is much less. So people get all worked up. There's a lot of hand-wringing. It's been going around for a while, people talking about it. But it wasn't until the Garland thing last week that the Senate actually decided to have a hearing about it. What can we do, you know?
So looking at the idea of the jihadist movement being largely an online movement, where does this put us with OPSEC on both our end as well as theirs?
Well, OPSEC is something that these guys have learned over time as people like me or the law enforcement agencies have, you know, found them and then take them away. You know, so in the case of let's just, because Daesh is the one that's really using this very well now, a lot of those people are in country. And so they're in Syria. We're not going to really reach them per se legally, but we can drone them. And there's been some cases where we've seen them tweeting with their GPS feature on. And so you know where they were at the time they tweeted. In country. Some reports came out, some research and some drone events. They started learning. They started picking up on that. Right now, in the last year, OPSEC has been something that because of the Snowden effect and because of the researchers and everybody in the security sphere talking about it, and it's out in the open now, the jihadis have also picked up on that. Specifically because now that Snowden put his documents out, everybody knows they're watching everything they can. So the OPSEC is the only way to really try to mitigate that, and protect yourself. So obfuscating your IPs, you know, being good about not mentioning where you are, not having the GPS turned on when you're tweeting, things like that. There's actually been a couple of manuals. There was one, I'd say about 3-4 months ago that came out on the Shamak board that, you know, laid it all out. You know, use Tails, use Tor. Here's some encrypted chat programs. And they'd been building their own over the years. We talked before about Jihadi Crypto. On the Loopcast. So they've been working on it. They've been using their own. They've been using others. But now they're learning that, well, you just can't use that stuff and expect not to get popped. You have to be careful about how you use it. There are steps to take. And that's the unfortunate bit, is that they've started learning. Like I said, these guys from Garland, they weren't stupid enough to say, yeah, we're going to go do this thing now. They just sort of went dark. And that's when, you know, people who were paying attention said, well, you know, they kind of mentioned this Garland thing a couple of times. Maybe they're, you know, thinking about doing it because the date is close. So, you know, you have that. There was a time that they would have said something, you know, like, yeah, I'm going to go do this, you know, and it could have been bluster or it could have been real. At least if somebody was paying attention, the alert would have been out. And it turns out it was anyway, but still.
Where would you place the evolution of jihadist media? So looking at other Islamic organizations like the Taliban, mainstream Al-Qaeda, and Daesh?
I would say that it's really all started mostly through 9/11. And those who were of devout faith, who saw this action and felt that, you know, the West had been messing with, you know, Islam, messing with the region for so long that it was time, you know, kick them out. And that was the stated goal. I mean, really, UBL didn't say we're going to come and take over America, unlike Daesh. He said, we want you out. out, everybody out. Maybe we'll leave you alone if you leave. But until you do, we're fighting you, and we're going to fight you there as well as here. Daesh is like, I don't care. You know what? We're gonna take over America. We're gonna make a new caliphate there, because they're just crazy enough to think that. So over time, the crazy is just sort of amped up, and I think it's because of the crazy levels with Daesh and their millenary ideas that has sparked this all being more important online, and the use of the social media, Web 2.0, has only snowballed that to a certain extent. So they're, you know, they say do something and it's all over the media. I mean, we're not helping it by having the media cycle that we do. It only feeds them. I recently, you know, got upset with somebody because they were tweeting about a paste bin that claimed that, you know, Daesh said, oh, we got 70 some odd guys and we're going to do, you know, something soon. And they're from these states, and it's a paste. I could have done it. You know, there's no proof of anything. And yet the media cycle goes berserk, and that only they win. They win when that happens. We're giving them more attention and more media focus for their own engine online, on Twitter or in other places, to say, look at that. They're scared. We did one little thing, and look at that. So I think that as we continue on, unless we learn to kind of handle it a little differently and really learn to combat on a propaganda level, this whole movement, we're only going to find ourselves repeating this cycle over and over again of, oh my God, a paste, you know, fear, fear, fear.
Mm-hmm. Do we see other groups embracing this social media campaign that we see Daesh, ISIS, however, whoever you want to call them, embracing and doing so well? Or is this really more associated with them? I mean, I know Al-Qaeda has had some, but what about other groups out there? Are they trying to copy or implement a similar plan?
Well, Boko Haram definitely has been very active in kind of copying, parroting what Daesh has been successful with. And in fact, Boko Haram and Daesh are, you know, they're on good terms, right? So there is at least that precedent with them. I haven't really strayed outside into other organizations outside of, you know, radical Islamic terrorism. But I'd imagine that if they're paying attention and seeing the cause and effect that Daesh is having, others will take up that, you know, that methodology in the future and use it. I think that not that Anonymous is a terrorist group, but they use media very well. And I think if anything, maybe Daesh learned a little bit from them. You know, if you are looking at the internet and you're seeing who's getting the attention, follow their example. So dropping these videos, dropping paste bins, promoting, you know, that kind of stuff. It's really simple, honestly. It's just a matter of getting that right balance to actually get somebody to act.
So looking at the jihadist approach to media, could you also term, for instance, Daesh, could you term them as hackivists? We've heard all these rumors and we've seen them taking over hashtags on Twitter, and there have been rumors about them hacking into websites. What are your thoughts on this?
I honestly don't think that there is a wing as yet that is Daesh hacking, you know, doing this thing in a concerted effort. The stuff that we have seen out of this alleged cyber caliphate may or may not have anything to do with Junaid Hussein trick from England I mean, he left England, went to Syria. He is there. But whether or not he's behind the caliphate, anyone's guess at this point. But the things that we've seen them do, yeah, it gets attention. But that's the extent of it. They haven't actually gone and done anything that I would consider a national threat. They went after easy targets. And, you know, on the scale of hacking and hacktivism, meh, it's not that impressive, but it's a flash in the pan and it does get media attention, right? When the Pentagon Twitter feed got hacked and taken over because of, you know, a social engineering password exploit, woo, everybody went crazy, you know, and it was just a Twitter feed. It's not like they got launch codes. Frankly, the Russians had more access to the State Department and the White House, you know, and we're not reacting the same way.
So I think one of the key words that keeps on popping up as you're discussing this is attention. Looking at that and jihadism, do you think attention and gaining more attention, more followers, more people talking about you is the main aspect of this campaign?
I think it is on a individual level. It's kind of a feedback loop. You've got these guys who are on Twitter. They have thousands of followers and they like it. You know, we all do. I have a little under 4,000 followers. I know we all kind of curate, you know, like, oh, how many do I have? You know, did I lose anybody? You know, that kind of stuff. We like it when people listen to us. So there's a human component to this, an egotistical component to this. And then there's the overall aegis that they may be trying to get out there by the core group, right? So I don't know how much the core group is saying, yeah, let's do this media, you know, front and do all this stuff. There's obviously they do have that content. They have their own magazine, Dabiq. So, you know, they do these things, but how many of these guys are, you know, just doing it because their commanders say so, and how much of it is, I enjoy doing this. I like getting the attention. So on a macroscopic scale, the attention is good for the core group. If they can get their word out and they can get potentially more people involved, they can get more, you know, funding, perhaps, not that they necessarily need it, in Daesh's case, support levels, things like that. And then on the personal level for these guys who are doing it, they're eating it up.
And you've just alluded to commanding whatever their group is commanding. And I was wondering if we could briefly look at Daesh's leadership versus jihadists in terms of like military intelligence. What is the experience that they're gaining out of this? What are they learning? What are they not learning from this? How is that all working in the big scheme of things?
For Daesh itself?
Yes.
I think they've got some pretty savvy individuals. I don't know what the attrition is like right now. There's been so many reports of drone hits that have taken out certain individuals and somebody's new in there. Al-Baghdadi, he might as well be the cat in the box in the thought experiment right now. Nobody knows if he's dead or alive. But they've gotten a taste of success from this campaign, the campaigns that they've been doing. So obviously it's going to be, you know, something that they'll continue. They won't put a stop to it. They've seen feedback, so they're going to continue to do it. And I think they've learned over time how to become more OPSEC friendly and how to leverage the technology in a way that really furthers their own personal goals as well as the goal of the organization. So it's not going to stop. It's only going to ramp up until such time as, you know, you kind of go in to the region. You know, you go into Syria and you rout them out. You know, you force them into a corner where they don't have all the time in the world to have these guys tweeting, you know, or putting out magazines, or, you know, they even have an FM radio station in the region. So, hey, you know, I was looking for long wave to see if they had any short wave transceivers that they were out there putting their stuff out. I haven't found any yet, but, you know, it's potentially there too. So as a media group, they're pretty good.
And so being a former guest on the Loopcast, you know that we like to give our guests a moment at the conclusion of the talk to maybe touch on something that we might not have touched on, or if you have a grand final comment to make. So I'd like to, yeah, we'll make this grandiose. So I'd like to pass it on to you and give you that opportunity.
Okay. Well, first of all, thanks for having
me. Thank you for coming on.
Well, you're welcome. I think that it is important that the Senate hearing happened this week. I really feel that left unchecked, this whole war ongoing on social media will only continue to burgeon. And because they're Daesh is in a region where politically it's not expedient for us to just go in boots on the ground, we're having all these concerns about getting coalitions to actually fight them. These guys aren't going anywhere. They're kind of entrenched like a tick at this point. So until such time as you remove their capacity to do this stuff online, they're only going to continue to amp it up. And now we're seeing stuff like the paste bin. If the Just Paste It was in fact from somebody within Daesh, you got to take a little bit more care. You know, it may be bluster, but maybe not. Either way, they win. So they're winning in the media, in our minds. People are worried about this stuff. And now they're at that point. We're at the tipping point. You get a couple more of these people who just go and try to do something on U.S. soil. You want to see a constriction of rights and a constriction of, you know, the security apparatus and all kinds of more crazy. Like, you thought going through the airport was bad before, going to get worse. So having that Senate hearing and having an understanding of how social media works, and getting social scientists involved and psychiatrists and psychologists involved, along with analysts from CIA, NSA, FBI, is very important in order to kind of work against this juggernaut that's online. And I'm glad it happened finally that they're paying attention to it. And I think we all need to kind of pay attention to it.
Well, Scott, as always, thank you so much for coming on the show, and I'm sure you will be back on in the future, because as you said, this is something that is not just going to disappear at the click of a finger. This is something that is a long-term issue that we're all going to be dealing with. So thank you so much for coming on the Loopcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.